it's a good thing for us to just go around the table, so we all know who each other are, and then I'm happy to chair this committee.
Hold on a second.
This way.
Beth Penfield with Girls Burn and Dunleavy.
Kayla Anthony also with BND.
Stacy Kaplowitz with BND.
Dave Horn, member of the Supplemental.
Ron Warren, Planning and Zoning.
Stephanie Landrum, Economic Development.
Good morning, Ryan Tuhill, Alexandria Economic Development.
Morgan Rupp, City Budget Director.
Arthur Ricks, Budget Office.
Good morning, Sharon Lewis, ACPS.
And Richard Jackson, ACPS.
Erica Bullock, ACPS. Christine Madrick, Economic Development.
Mike Herbstman, ACPS.
Lois Berlin, ACPS.
Mark Johnson, Committee Member.
And you?
Catherine Fairway.
Person who keeps us all together.
Dave Bob's fire for.
Great, thank you so much. So I think since we don't have any community comments, if anyone had any comments about meeting number one and whether or not we've missed any of the high level, if no one has any comments about meeting number one, does anybody have any comments about meeting number one? Are you going to go through this? Oh, there they are. Okay, great.
Yeah, so essentially just a recap of what we had gone over in the last meeting. And we have the notes that, have they been posted? Yeah, they're going up.
They're going up, yeah.
And then they have the video as well, too.
Yeah.
So I think in continuing to frame our objectives in understanding what all of our resources are, what the statutory requirements are, what the options are within the city government and surrounding us, as we also understand the scope of work for both the city and the school system, we've asked Stephanie Landrum to come and talk to us today about the work that the Alexandria Economic Development Partnership does with the city, with economic development in general, with developers and owners, and frame out what their role is and what resources that they bring to bear that are specific to the discussion that we're having. So I welcome Stephanie.
Great to see you. We're excited to be here.
Kind of in the full disclosure, I sat on the board as a federal partner for a couple of years, several years ago, so we are acquainted.
Yes, Mignon, you know, worked on a really small project here in the city, the new headquarters of the National Science Foundation, and she was a delightful partner to have. We are so excited that they are almost all the way moved in now over in Eisenhower and working on their, like, celebration in November. Yes, it's nice to see you again. And also Dave Millard serves on my board, which I'll talk a little bit about. So for those I haven't met, I'm Stephanie Landrum. I'm the CEO of Economic Development. I've been with AEDP for more than 12 years. I've been the CEO for the last two and a couple of months. And I brought my colleagues with me, Christina Mindrup and Ryan Tuhill. We'll kind of tag team and they'll chime in when I say things incorrectly or we want to add to the discussion. But we wanted to start off by talking a little bit about who we are, how we're structured, so that you all understand as you're making your decisions and recommendations if there's any role for us to play, whether it's informal in sharing information or more formal in participating in whatever it is you might recommend. So AEDP is really focused on the idea of growing the city, and the growth is really threefold. It's growing our real estate portfolio here. We want more commercial real estate. We want more valuable real estate in general. Secondly, we're trying to grow the number of businesses who call Alexandria home so that the tax burden is frankly more spread out. The business community is contributing more, and residents, like most of us, have to pay lower taxes to maintain the same services. And the third is focused on growing the businesses that are here, growing their bottom lines, so that they're making more money, and in essence, the city is making more money. So it's growth is sort of our theme. We have memorialized that in some of our documents and materials. Our vision and goal is sort of, as I just explained, it's about growing the tax base. We want to make sure that we're not too beholden to any one industry. We talk a lot about diversifying from federal government dependency. One of the things that was so fantastic about attracting the National Science Foundation here is that the city's portfolio from a federal perspective was really focused on Department of Defense. and the Patent and Trademark Office. And in 2005, the Department of Defense made wholesale sweeping changes through something they call BRAC, and we lost thousands and thousands of jobs and hundreds of thousands of square feet of commercially leased space. It was the first time that had ever been done in BRAC, and we were very susceptible. And our neighbor, Arlington, lost probably triple what we did. And so as a co-region, the two of us, we're still recovering from the impacts of BRAC. Alexandria's done a lot better because we had almost a smaller impact and we were able to win NSF. Crystal City is still, daily talks about sort of that recovery from BRAC. So this idea of diversification is something that we have been focused on really since 2005. And then, as I mentioned, attracting and retaining businesses. I wanted to talk a little bit about our structure because I think that's important. AEDP is a 501c6 nonprofit organization, and we get all of our funding from the City of Alexandria through the general fund process. So like every department, like Carl and Jeremy, we participate in the city's budget process each year, and we're very aligned with them. We work extremely collaboratively. But we are intentionally structured as a 501c6 because it gives us flexibility to do some things that the traditional city government is unable to do. One of the things, and we'll go through this here in detail, is that I report to a board of directors, so I don't report to the city manager. And that board of directors are all private sector, essentially people who live here in the city. And that is intentionally structured that way because those people, like Dave Millard, are coming from the private sector and are living sort of the bottom line of the business community every day. And that helps then set our strategic vision. Now, my colleagues here at the city can tell you, if I go rogue and do stuff that the city manager doesn't like, I'm not gonna be around for long, nor is our organization, so it is a balance. But again, that structure is intentional, and probably about every 5 years, we end up having some sort of conversation about whether that's appropriate, whether that's the best structure for the city. And in my 12 and a half years, three times now, we've come back and said, this is the right thing, it's working well, and it gives us the ability to accomplish our goals. Here's our board. This is actually a little bit dated. This was our board as of June 30, but I put this up here because I want you to see the type of people who are helping then shape the strategy. It's bankers, it's real estate brokers, it's real estate investors and holders, it's research and data analysts, people who do feasibility studies, lots of people in finance. People who brokerage for retail. We spend a lot of time working on some of what we'd call like the softer programs related to economic development. Christina single-handedly has been running a pop-up retail program for the last 9 months. And some of them are just, straight industry, own wireless companies, developers, residential developers, mixed-use developers. So this is the group of people then who help shape the strategy that AEDP operates under each day. The other entity that I wanted to talk a little bit about that I think is probably relevant for your group to understand is the Industrial Development Authority. And IDAs are actually state entities that are set up at the local level, and the members who sit on the IDA are appointed by the local city council. And they are essentially a pass-through entity for issuing bonds to fund real estate projects. And traditionally in Alexandria, we use the IDA for qualified nonprofit organizations to help them buy buildings, renovate buildings, buy equipment, et cetera. And so some recent examples are the National Industries for the Blind is building the first office building at the Potomac Yard Metro. They came through the IDA. As a pass-through, it's essentially a kind of a stamp that an IDA gives to a qualified nonprofit to then go out and issue tax-exempt bonds. And so the tax-exempt bonds allows them to get a lower interest rate and then finance the project at a savings overall. Mm-hmm. So the NIB project, which I should have looked up the number, but it's probably $70 million total, something like that. Maybe I'm underestimating. But they're able to access then lower cost of capital to build these buildings. IDAs, by statute throughout the state, are actually enabled to do a lot more than just pass-through bond financing for nonprofits. IDAs in other parts of the state hold properties for the jurisdictions. The jurisdiction can transfer the ownership to the IDA. They can build things like public parking garages or other entities that have some sort of public use. the reason it's named industrial, they, in other parts of the state, they actually build industrial parks to then go out and create the product to attract businesses. And so they own the land, they build the building, and then they go out and execute leases with a private company. And so it is a way to bring in companies into these jurisdictions. We haven't done any of that here in the city because we've had a generally pretty healthy economy. But over recent years, we've started to talk about, is it time for us to explore what other powers the IDA has? And is the IDA the appropriate tool to help us with some of these more complicated projects? The one project where we actually have had the discussion thus far is about Landmark Mall. So Landmark Mall is a complicated 52-acre property, and we have been in discussions for probably 10 years since the small area plan was adopted to figure out, is there a role where the IDA could potentially build, fund some of the public improvements that are part of that, you know, is it a parking deck? Is it part of the infrastructure? Is it part of the public spaces? And because of the private side of this project has been delayed for multiple reasons, we just haven't really gotten too far along in that process. So this is something I think that, again, given your conversation and especially the subcommittee looking at alternative delivery models, this may be an authority or an entity that you want to look a little bit more into. AEDP is the administrator of this program, and we would be happy to have further discussions or provide more information. We rely on very competent legal counsel who are bond specialists to kind of answer the more difficult questions, but I at least wanted to flag this for you. And then I think maybe the last thing I'll say, and then my colleagues can kind of chime in, or you guys can ask us questions, is, you know, our approach at AEDP is really focused on this idea that the city as a whole is our asset. So we don't own anything right now. Maybe we'll own something in the future, who knows, but we don't own anything right now, but we sort of see our responsibility as knowing who owns what throughout the city and what their plans are. And so on a day-to-day basis, we are talking to property owners and people who are thinking about investing, and we know what businesses are maybe thinking about moving that might change the financial dynamics of a building, which then might incent that owner to sell. And our role then is to share that information with people to kind of facilitate deals. And so, you know, Christina's background is in asset management and brokerage. Ryan's background is in sort of budget, and he understands sort of the city's priorities. We have other members of our team who have come from the private sector who were brokers. Our goal is to essentially act as the all-knowing when it comes to real estate and business and you know, movements within the city. And so on a day-to-day basis, the private sector comes to us and says, hey, I've got, you know, a broker. I have a client who's looking for real estate. I've run, you know, CoStar database searches, and I've talked to all my colleagues, but we want to check in with you because we know you guys might know something that's not yet, you know, on the market. And over recent years, I think we have tried to play that role with the city. The General Services Office, Jeremy and his team oftentimes reaches out to us as they're, you know, getting ready to look for, at real estate. We've done a little bit of work with the schools, but not as much. But we don't feel like, just very bluntly, that the city is taking full advantage that the private sector does with us. And I think that that's an area of opportunity for us. I'm trying to think if there was, are there other points that I missed? This is like a very long monologue here. I guess the last thing that I would say is back to kind of the explanation about how we're structured. I mean, we are intentionally structured to allow for flexibility, and I feel like we're just starting to explore what that flexibility might be able to provide to help the city reach some of its goals. We have done traditional economic development for the first 20 years of our existence. Over the last 5, we've really started to do different things, and I think, you know, moving forward, there potentially is a role for us to help with some of these larger real estate discussions that the city's having. So,
can I ask a quick question about the Industrial Development Authority? Mm-hmm. So, a qualified 501c3, do they go through an application process?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so 501c3s are not the only qualified entity. Okay. Manufacturers are, and so here in the city, something like a brewery, a printing press, there are projects like that that are qualified because of the nature of the enabling legislation. It was industrial. Parking, anything parking related, parking facilities. We've done educational facilities. We have done bonds for Inova Hospital multiple times. Episcopal High School is a major user. because of the mix of who we have here, we actually have a good number of applicants that we've worked on just in my 12 years. But we tend to really focus on the office side of things because that's, you know, that's kind of what our role is to try to generate more commercial activity.
Are there limitations in terms of amount of bonds?
No. So I'd say the largest bond we did was $100 million for the Institute for Defense Analysis when Mark Center was being sold by the Winkler Companies and Duke Realty came in and JBG came in. They took the opportunity to buy the building that they were in and a parcel for future growth. And so they issued bonds, $100 million worth of bonds to facilitate that. We've done, it doesn't really make sense to do bonds under $2 million, $2.5 million probably, but we have done some of the smaller ones, people who buy an office condo in, you know, one of the office in 1001 North Fairfax, or so the range is pretty.
So talk about the challenges and the opportunities that repositioning, repurposing mm-hmm. offers, mm-hmm. as opposed to new development in places like Carlisle, Potomac Yards, and kind of what's driving both of them.
Right? Sure. Well, so our team worked with Carl's team on a study called Office Competitiveness and Conversion, and we delivered the findings to City Council back in April, I think. April, May,
yeah.
Something like that. And essentially, the big takeaway, which was eye-opening for the city, was that converting commercial properties to residential was not a net negative financially, that it was actually positive. We looked at case studies of projects that had been done, and then we also looked at, there were a couple that were already in the queue. And part of the reason that we were looking at this is, one, there was the beginning of a trend, but two, as a city, we didn't really have a policy. And so Carl's team was being asked questions almost weekly, somebody coming in saying, like, can we convert this to residential? And his team was in a position to say, we don't have a policy yet. And so we were telling a lot of people to sort of hold, which I think from the city's perspective is, you know, all of us agree that that's not the right approach because we're holding off investment and the increase of real estate value. So we completed the study, and as I said, what the study found is that the conversion, the examples we used were the Orinoco building on the waterfront, the International Chiefs of Police building on North Washington Street, the public health building, the city's old public health facility on St. Asaph, yeah, and ELOFs at 4501 Ford Avenue on the West End. And all of those projects at least doubled in value, in real estate value, some of them much, much more. And the second, I think, finding that we had was part of our issue with attracting top-notch office tenants was that we didn't have the right office stock. So we have this beautiful building that NSF built. It's the only new office building that's been built in the city over the last few years. And prior to that, the only new office building that had been built was for another user. So we didn't have any new Class A office space delivering, and part of what impacts those financials for developers is they look at what the vacancy rate is. And so by having more vacancy in old obsolete office, it was sort of, it not only was it just sitting there not being, you know, attracting investment, it was potentially impacting the desire for new people to build new office building. So converting obsolete office not only creates new real estate value, it lowers the vacancy rate, which then creates the demand for the people to build new office building at transit-oriented locations, which is our, honestly, it's our major goal, right? And Dave could probably talk a little bit about this as well, but we could use the Nestle headquarters as an example. So Nestle came to this region about a year ago and said, present to us options for moving our headquarters from California. And all of us had just, you know, put together an RFP and we said, okay, great. Their requirement was occupancy in 2017. I guess it was a year ago. Occupancy in 2017. We had one building in the city that met their needs. And frankly, that building is in renovation and wouldn't have been able to be done. So we could not compete because we don't have the product. So this study that we finished, I mean, again, the big takeaway was conversion is not bad. And it helps us with our ultimate goal of getting new Class A office built.
Is the perception that conversion is bad, is that sort of a public perception that needs to be?
Yes. So I would say that it has its roots in a study process that some of us were involved in 10 years ago called economic sustainability. And the general takeaway from economic sustainability was we should be aiming for a 50-50 commercial residential tax base. Having been part of that group, it really wasn't based on any scientific data. And so the idea of converting something commercial to residential has been, oh no, we're already way off on our balance. Like, we cannot allow these conversions because, you know, we have this goal of getting back to 50-50. So that's kind of what it's based in. Doing this financial modeling of these buildings to be able to say this is not a bad thing for us financially was an important part of the study.
So it's sort of unwinding that initial perception.
That's right. Initial goal. That's right. And then, you know, Carl can talk to you a little bit too about the uses in these residential buildings. I mean, residential is not what it used to be. And so it's not just people who sleep there overnight and then leave for the day. People are using residential buildings differently. And as we're trying to build mixed-use neighborhoods, we're less concerned about having a 50-50 mix by building, and we're more concerned about having a 50-50 mix by people, right?
Right. So we were, I'm looking in Eisenhower East because a number of people had come in to ask if a planned office building or an existing office building could be converted. And so one of the things we were interested in was making sure there's a daytime, nighttime population that can support retail. Because if you have good retail, then you can attract more office. I mean, it's an important part of the mix. So, but when we looked at the residential, we were finding that many people are working from home. So there's actually a daytime population, a employment population happening in the residential buildings that wasn't captured in previous studies. And so that was just one of the factors that led us to say, okay, we can we can support more residential in Eisenhower East because it's going to have these positive impacts.
Did the study look at the impact on schools and the number of children that would increase as you increase residential?
Yes, the fiscal impact model explicitly includes the student generation. We looked at student generation rates. We have been looking at them in collaboration with the school system for a while now. But that was part of the model. So if a new development is residential, we use the student generation rates to determine how many kids are coming, and then use the average cost per student. And we worked with your staff to do those numbers.
And it's sensitive to the type of unit being brought online, right?
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
So these are all market-based units.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other distinct factor about the ones that we're reading.
That's right.
In reading some of the voluminous material that we've been given, it looked at the cohorts for student generation based on age of housing stock as well as ownership type.
Right.
When the city is modeling the economic impact of a new unit, whatever type it is, is it applying this same average rate, or is it saying this is going to generate based on it being in the recent 10-year cohort, which is 0.00 whatever,
yeah,
students?
So we call new anything 30 years and less. There's two rationales for that. One is the housing stock that was built 30 years ago is a bit different in type than it is today. But we're not building new garden apartments typically. The main point of it is ultimately new development becomes existing development. After 30 years of paying taxes, maybe that housing unit is no longer considered sort of a new impact to the city, and it's just paying its taxes like everybody else and contributing to the school system and everything else. So there were clear differences in the student generation rates in a couple of housing types, particularly garden apartments, when you look at those 30 years and less and then 30 years and older. So we felt it was appropriate to apply a student generation rate that we could expect from new development. That's how we do it.
So the new development, you would look at the less than 30 year and apply that?
Right, exactly.
And conversion resets that clock. So when you convert an old office building into a new residential building, the building age is still 50, 60 years old, but the project from a fiscal impact kind of resets. I think the other thing that we've realized is the same is true with commercial assets as residential. So the 30, 40, 50-year-old office buildings that haven't had investment haven't been upgraded are not performing as financially well as they could be. And so our overall goal is to encourage new investment in all buildings, right? Because we want the entire real estate value base to grow.
So can you talk about when you say encourage? Mm-hmm. Like, is that just your cheerleader on the sideline saying go, go, go? Or what tools do you have besides the IDA to actually make that happen?
Sure. So, I mean, right, we do a ton of cheerleading. I mean, that is our day-to-day job. But a lot of what we do is the exchange of information and presenting opportunities to people who are looking to make investments. And so one of the things that has been fascinating over the last few years are the number of new developers and investors in the city who have never been here before. And a lot of that comes from exchanging years. I mean, we can't even draw a direct line, right? But years of presenting information and raising the profile of Alexandria's opportunities, the changes that have been made in the code department and the planning processes to make it easier to do business here. I mean, all of it's 10 years worth of work that is now resulting in this new investment. As far as other tools that we do have, we do have an incentive program that we established last year. It is focused on businesses, on attracting businesses, but it absolutely can benefit sort of the real estate side of things, because most businesses, the largest bill that they pay is their real estate tax passed through in their lease rates. And so we are able to, on a case-by-case basis, negotiate incentives for businesses that are either expanding here or relocating here. The IDA is probably the cleanest tool that we have to encourage the construction of new development.
And then we also, through this study, we were asked to come back with specific recommendations this fall to City Council, specifically related to the conversion issue, because there's some statutory ability that we have to provide tax credits so that people with older assets can, you know, make those capital investments, but then there's a tax credit that they can then take advantage of. So by injecting that capital back into those buildings, the value will go up, they get a break to some degree on their taxes, and so that's one policy that we're looking at coming back with in the fall.
So ask this, why can't or won't private sector companies or the federal government, GSA, or government users that GSA works for lease space at Victory Center?
So
you are limited to 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. So there are probably a number of answers we could give, but I think that the general issue is that Eisenhower West does not have the amenity base for any office user, whether it's GSA or otherwise. But the amenity base is not going to come until there is a catalyst office user, frankly. And so so the city staff has adopted like this fantastic visionary Eisenhower West plan that has a ton of flexibility, but the one thing that we can't control is that catalyst project. And so for the past 10 years, we have been thinking that filling the Victory Center would be that catalyst project, and we have now gone after 4 very large GSA requirements, and we have lost exactly 4 GSA requirements. We have one more that we're working on. We internally have talked about this a little bit. I mean, it is time for us to be talking about Plan E, for that facility. But the building itself is held in a real estate trust that is focused on government-held properties. And so they are not really looking at Plan E at this point, because they're like all in for this last.
So do you have a Plan E identified, or you're saying we need to come up with one?
I'm saying we need to come up with one. And it's either a planning tactic, which is, you know, we go back and through the Eisenhower West plan and we look at that parcel and we say we want to add a ton of density or value to it to encourage them to tear down the building and build something else. Or we identify some other sort of use or opportunity for that building to be the catalyst that then can kick off Eisenhower West.
And unlike the situation that the school was able to take advantage of, where the building, Mark Center, I believe, was in servicing, which was effectively bankruptcy, Prudential, the owner of Victory Center, they're not going to lose the building.
That's right.
So nobody's going to get the building, you know, for a really good deal. However,
That's right.
after 7 years or so and completely renovating the building, I would think even a, you know, I mean, some analysts sitting in Prudential's offices somewhere should understand that our plan E, if we come up with
yes.
one, will make some sense.
That's right.
Has the building been renovated in the last, what?
Well, 7 years
renovated and mothballed.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was renovated about probably 8 years ago. It was completed. It was all external renovations.
Okay, so having sat on a couple of the evaluation panels mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. the Victory
yes.
Center, it was also, from a timing perspective, there were also more complicated reasons that maybe the GSA didn't really speak to, but
mm-hmm.
some of it had to do with security issues. Mm-hmm. Some of it had to do with that 8-foot ceiling height.
That's
that
the
ceiling height
yep.
in there is deadly.
Yeah.
It cannot, you're not, you never get a federal tenant with that ceiling height. And so there are a couple of structural, and that's just the way it was built when it was renovated.
Mm-hmm.
I thought something else had happened that I didn't know
yeah,
about.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah. I was like, oh, so
yeah.
I put more money into that thing?
No.
So it was really a dead cow from
yeah.
from the federal side. And so, you know, to be very honest with you, GSA never really seriously considered it,
mm-hmm.
which wasted a lot of people's time and money,
mm-hmm.
as far as I'm concerned.
And my sense is that even from an economic standpoint, when they would consider it, the users found reasons
That's
to
right.
say, I'm not going there. And in many different ways that you can subvert that. And this is it. Is this a, even an 8-foot ceiling? I mean, this is basically.
Oh, yeah, it's probably 9.
Yeah.
You go, I can touch the set, the ceiling.
And where did you play basketball?
some areas.
The one other thing. The one other thing that I would mention that we that our team is just starting to look at is we've been reading this book called The Public Wealth of Cities, and it's focused on this idea that traditionally cities, municipalities, states, countries look at their assets and have either said we own it, we manage it, we you know use it, or we sell it to make money, and that there's really this third model, and the third model is where the locality actually continues to own the property, but does a public-private partnership with a private sector asset manager. And the deals are structured so that the private sector asset manager is incented to basically run that asset in the most profitable way possible, and then both entities share in the revenue. And so, you know, I know this is being recorded, I'll say it anyway, the third rail, but something like the Torpedo Factory potentially would be a very interesting asset to think about using something like that model. The concern from the city's perspective has always been, we don't want to get rid, you know, we don't want to lose the valuable real estate, but we're struggling with how that building is run. We've now taken back control and we're trying to run it ourselves, and it costs us a lot of time and energy and expertise. Is there a model where, you know, we would potentially try that, and you bring somebody in, and there are, you know, it's a contract and there are parameters in place, and so it has to remain an art center, or it has to, you know, whatever. But it's the way to utilize and access the best of the private sector while protecting the locality's interests. So there are countries who put all of their assets into essentially like a managed REIT and use this model. It's fascinating. I mean, Singapore operates this way, and then there are examples here stateside of localities who are trying it. So trying to read a little bit more about this, you know, kind of understand. I mean, certainly doing something like this would be very out of the box and would require some flexibility, and we would never kind of jump all in and do everything, but it might be worth us looking at some specific assets where we try some things like this.
Some of the, along that line, the higher education institutions that we work with have done that model. It's called the concessionaire model, where basically, if you think about, like, a university is not in the business of running and operating housing and concerned about that as much, so they sort of give that responsibility to an operator, and then, I mean, it's the same thing, and so we've seen that a lot in student housing and in some other recreation centers and other sort of quality of life or revenue generating
yeah.
assets.
It's also a way to access capital from the private sector upfront, which is the other thing that we're struggling with, right? Is we have $25 million of deferred maintenance at the torpedo factory, and that sits at the end of our CIP. And so how do you get access to that capital that you need? And, you know, how do you structure a deal where it makes sense for the private sector to bring that capital to the table?
So we don't have to, like, go to other countries. A lot of the jurisdictions in Virginia utilize this on a lot of assets. Like, the Norfolk just did their waterfront entertainment district with Cordish. Mm-hmm. And it had become completely dilapidated. They'd taken back control of it. They were running terrible. The roof cost $1 million to fix. All of a sudden, they put out an RFP, and $1 million liability turns into a revenue stream.
Right. And so, this is the Cordish that did a lot of the Baltimore.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of those things out there in the state of Virginia, so it's not that.
So you're saying you shouldn't fly to Singapore?
You can take the Greyhound in Norfolk or Amtrak.
I think it also challenges, and it will challenge, which is fine. I think that we should, that's what we're here to do, is to challenge the structure, the way that the city and the school system have talked about control, management, what we're willing to do to suggest those changes. I think it's the conversation that we are trying to have.
Yeah, and I think there's a number of assets which currently represent, like you said, big CIP liability that.
Both on the city side, on just the city and private side.
Yeah. And if you all of a sudden did a public-private deal where you share the upside, all of a sudden that liability disappears and it produces revenue.
Right.
It has a material impact on the total CIP availability.
And you're meeting. I mean, the third thing is that you're meeting a defined public need, right? Whether it's affordable housing, or arts and recreation, or culture, or schools, or whatever. I mean, so you're slowly but surely executing the city's priorities.
Yeah, I mean, Gatsby's Tavern is another one that comes to mind. It seems like that is a restaurant entertainment venue that I'm sure the city does an adequate job. Is there somebody that does that for a living that they would run it tighter and be able to provide the capital required to keep the place the next 200 years and shit. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a number of those, and I'm not sure how much that's been explored, but we certainly plan to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is a plan B or if it's even a plan with a letter in front of it, but once a company gets big enough so that their location of their office is no longer determined by where the CEO lives, large companies will do searches for where their employees come from, do a zip code search, and that provides some guidance. Obviously, you know, who your clients are also is a factor, but to that end, do we know on two fronts where all the city employees live from a zip code perspective, and is that instructive about where our office space ought to be, number one? And then not for teachers, obviously, because we're always going to have to be in the schools. But for administrative staff at the schools, do we know where all of the administrators live and come from in the morning? Those that have to be out and about, that's different. But I think if we don't have something like that for both the schools and the city, I think we should. Because it might be instructive as to where our offices need to be located for both.
Can you talk about what the conversation is when you're talking to potential users about housing stock, mm-hmm. affordability of housing, variety of housing, what the feedback is from when they say, we want to look at Alexandria, mm-hmm. and then they say, what do they say about our housing stock and availability?
Sure. So I did bring a couple of things to, in case anybody was interested, but sort of this is how we're kind of promoting the city. And then this is essentially we take Carl's plans and we turn them into marketing documents, and we go out and we try to say, look at all this amazing density and investment opportunity, and so this is what we use. To answer your question on housing stock, and I'd put workforce and I would put transportation into the category as well. We don't necessarily tell the Alexandria story alone, we tell the regional story. Because the reality is that the majority of people who do work here in the city in office buildings don't live here. I forget what the number is, but it's something like 70%, I want to say, in, like, when you look at census data, like, people commuting, we have 70, 70% of the people who work here are coming from somewhere else, and 70% of the people who live here are commuting somewhere else to work. And so we tell this sort of broader story about the region when it comes to housing stock. We certainly hear feedback that it's not affordable. And when you look at our tourism industries in particular, hotels, restaurant, which we have a ton of, we hear a lot about attracting workforce, how competitive it is to keep that workforce with things like MGM and National Harbor and the living wage in DC? That's now higher than the wages here. And so once you lose a couple of hospitality employees, you're then right looking to recruit people who live in Woodbridge and Prince William County and et cetera. So it is an issue from definitely from that industry perspective, but we hear it from office tenants as well. We specifically don't go after software companies, software development, because almost all of the people who work in those companies live out in Ashburn. And the commute from that part of Fairfax County to here is horrendous. And it's just not realistic. We have talked to people who run types of companies here, and that's what they say. They open satellite offices out there. So the continued mix and diversity of housing is as important to us as the reputation and performance of the schools. I mean, Dave can tell you, we sit in our AEDP board meetings, and we're definitely talking about development projects and tax rates, et cetera, but we always devolve into, the reputation of our school system is absolutely important to our ability to attract people, businesses to come here. And the type of housing we have, and we need more of it, frankly, is important to us continuing to attract businesses.
You mentioned it earlier, and I think that that's what the point of the committee is, and that is to connect. The reason why I asked for you to come was specifically to understand if those brochures have the word learn in it or school in it. Whereas where we're talking about, the reputation of the schools is one thing, but incorporating the schools into the marketing issue as part of a development opportunity is where can we leverage that?
Sure.
And the work, play, learn, the work, play, live, work,
yeah.
play becomes, and learn adds,
sure.
adds on to that.
Sure.
When I started my career in this area in the early 1980s, I was the property manager for Crystal City before Crystal Drive was built.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Crystal City. My kids went to school in Arlington, and we lived in Crystal Square.
Mm-hmm.
And I managed the underground and all of the residential and commercial buildings that were along Jefferson Davis Highway. And it was a very interesting thing, because my kids were the only kids at that time in 1980, whatever, early, in Crystal Square. And but the school was connected to the school bus game.
Right.
But I'm not saying we recreate Crystal City. I think that was good at that time, has an advantage, but if we can learn from some
sure.
of the advantages, some of the things that we took in terms of the portfolio that's here in the city, where are there opportunities where we can do a combined mixed-use development that includes the expansion that we need in our schools or
Do you want to talk about daycare and school requirements and just the frequency and how important that is?
We joke that I hit a lot of the school requirements here, but they're, having children of my own to be on a waiting list for 20 months just for daycare is incredible. And so we get, and I think it's because the location of Alexandria is so proximate to DC, and we do have so many people living out down towards Mount Vernon, we are an ideal location for those daycare users. And I hate to say, after 9/11, to be able to take your child closer to work is more preferable than leaving them somewhere else and having to drive to go get them through traffic. But I would say I get daycare requirements at least weekly, if not twice a week, looking from anywhere from infant share into something larger. Bright Horizons is probably one of the best groups that's providing it there. PTO, the patent trade office, actually has a 400 family waiting list for daycare, and they already have one on site. They felt so confident about that Carlisle neighborhood that they actually opened a 163 family new daycare that was full at opening. So there is constant need, and I know the National Science Foundation, that was one of their needs, and I know that there is daycare actually looking at infant care, looking at the National Science Foundation But, and I think the city opened up the opportunity of making first floor retail space that was obsolete or not desirable into daycare has been a huge win for the city. Also just putting feet on the street and helping our retail market, because more people are in that area wanting to go to dinner and not go through traffic. And it's helped Carlisle in that area, just having that daycare there. But I, at Stephanie's point, I get them weekly. And it's harder and harder to find, but I think the city is coming up with creative ideas for play space, for occupying office space that's either obsolete, looking at retail space. So I don't know how much more to get into. I can go all of it.
Carl, does anyone ever take up the bonus density for providing daycare in the zoning code? Is that used ever? In new development?
I don't believe it has ever been used.
I don't know, Perseus was considering it for the 200 stall conversion. Yes, towards the back, because we talked about that there, but I don't know if that was the vehicle that
Well, ultimately,
they
didn't did
really,
they
didn't
did
use
the,
it.
But. Right, because the density
was
given to them
without
the daycare center.
Right, so I guess that is a tool that's effective if we've got waiting lists everywhere. The tool that no one uses, maybe we could look at refashioning the tool as a regulatory inducement to help provide more seats.
The density bonus is a incentive that currently is almost entirely used for affordable housing. And if you expand the use of that incentive to a variety of other things, then you just have to be careful. I'm sure you do.
No, I understand. Build affordable housing and,
yes, exactly.
And
sure.
Do the net present value. But it sounds like that is a critical issue to attracting and retaining business, and the tool that you put aside in the zoning code to help facilitate that isn't getting used.
I think one thing that we have done, and I think with Bright Horizons really was the inspiration for this, was saying where we have regulatory barriers to providing daycare, which is either in our small area plans where we didn't count daycare as a retail, or we required special use permits and going to hearing to get a daycare center, we've eliminated much of that.
Great.
So the moving in process is considerably easier, and every building has ground floor, so there's much more potential spaces for daycare centers now than there were even 2 years ago.
More creative opportunities for. I mean, there was a daycare in the second floor space of an office building, but it happened to be on grade with grassy area and parkland. So, you know, having a daycare within an office building, I mean, that's something you don't, even on the second floor, that's something it's unheard of. But those opportunities in the city working with schools and daycares of that nature make those real. They're actually incentives for companies to move in that area, to be able to bring their children to school, to bring them within that proximity. It's a huge incentive.
And I just one more thing is that I think also Bright Horizons and working with ADP on that sort of opened my eyes to the fact that we sort of inadvertently sort of banned kids from urban centers by not treating daycare centers as retail and making it hard to move in. And in fact, they're activity generators, obviously, and going out into a public plaza instead of just seeing folks having their lunch, you know, adults having lunch. If kids are running around playing, isn't that more attractive? Isn't that a better environment for people? So finding ways to sort of reintegrate the youngest of our population into the urban part of our city.
And the argument that I was not really successful at making for National Science Foundation was that the base of their work there's people who are there like at the trademark come to work every day, but the huge influx of people coming from around the country to do work there and want to bring their kids and are staying for a temporary period of time.
Right.
And they can't, and unless the NSF finds some way to accommodate that, which they were doing in Arlington with the daycare center, temporary or, you know, as needed. But, you know, again, when you ban or you don't make it easy, then they're having problems getting people to come and sit on the board when they do come. And they do a lot of it externally, but They gotta come and vote in $1 billion of science project. They need to come, sure. And a lot of people want to bring their kids with them.
Sure. And I think from the school's perspective, I mean, the thing to think about is how many of the schools are operating before and after, I don't know, you don't call it daycare.
Oh,
do you? Okay. And so
before and after care.
Before and after care. But so that is, you know, is filling that same role. And so having more opportunities to have them, having them integrated into some of our neighborhoods so that it's easy access for people who live and work here. I mean, all of that is sort of helping us do our job. And so it is important.
I would like to backtrack a little bit and shift the conversation back to the discussion about the IDA.
Okay.
And the potential opportunities with bond funds and schools and what the tolerance level is of the city to take on debt and those types of things. And I think that's a question that needs to be discussed. I don't know. I mean, do we wholly own all of our school buildings? Is there debt on any of our buildings? Is we, you know, go floating bonds? Are there issues associated with that that are that there is or isn't a structure or tolerance level for within the budget within the city council or within, I mean, I'm just asking some questions because my understanding was that we wholly own all of our facilities. That's a correct statement.
As far as schools are concerned, I can't speak to every single individual school, but I believe most of, if not all, the school properties are owned by the schools. And as far as debt is concerned, probably anything that's been renovated or constructed within that past 30 years has outstanding debt on it, unless there's been a refinancing, and you know we'd have to go back through records and see what has been paid off and what's still outstanding. I don't know if you have anything to add on that.
No, I mean it's not like Patrick Henry. Well, that's a bad example, but it's not like the debt's held at the school by school level, but we have, you know, all of our bonds attributed to specific renovation projects, so we do have the ability to track down where there's still debt outstanding on, you know, a roof replacement at a school or what have you. So we do have that data available.
But the bond, when a project needs to be done, the real estate is not pledged for that debt. The debt was taken out in order to fund that, but the security of the debt is not a specific asset. It's the general credit worthiness of whoever the borrower is, ACPS or Alexandria City. So I think what Mignon is getting at is, can the IDA facilitate a transaction with a entity that takes out debt for this specific creation or renovation or rebuilding of a specific asset, and that asset is pledged?
Yeah, and maybe a combination type of, in a context that's not just a school. It's the school and the fire department, mm-hmm. and whatever to be renovated with certain other assets or city. I mean, you create a development project.
And I think the advantage, and I think that is one of the alternatives that I don't think that the city has used, because that takes out of when the IDA issues a bond as a conduit, the debt obligation, it doesn't show up on the balance sheet of the ACPS or the city, it shows up on the entity that was used to create that.
That's right.
And the only obligation that might show up would be the lease obligation requirements that we send it back to the city or whoever
right.
the user is, whether
yeah.
it's a private sector or so on. Mm-hmm. And so that may be a way to introduce additional capital in without destroying the credit worthiness of
yeah.
our city.
I think, this is definitely where we would very much benefit from legal counsel who is qualified to answer this question. But we've talked about these models a little bit. The concern is who's backstopping this new entity, right? Like, who's the fiscal backstop of this new entity?
Mm-hmm. And so in my day job, our company uses IDAs in the state to issue bonds as the funding conduit, and then we are the borrower of it, and so you know, the IDA gets paid a fee and
mm-hmm.
so on
yep.
For managing it.
But I think in this, the school model, there'd have to be some.
A private partner?
Yes, and the private partner has to earn a profit. If they're going to take risk, put capital up. Is it a design, build, deliver, finance? It's $1 million a year lease. The city provides the land, whatever it is. But I think it could be a solution to one of our challenges, which is we have a limitation on the amount of capital we have available.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we get everything else really efficient, if there's still a shortfall, is this one of the sources to bring private capital to bear?
And I think it's at some point where we can look at what projects
mm-hmm.
are either stalled or you have available or that you're looking at, or private developers have come in and just ask some questions, or that you're trying to pursue.
Sure.
And maybe there's, you know, five big ones around that we all sort of know about, but your, you know,
mm-hmm.
input to that would be
mm-hmm.
really helpful. I mean, like you mentioned Landmark. I mean, we all know that Landmark needs, you know, help. The Victory Center needs help.
Mm-hmm.
You know that maybe there are some other ones that you're focused on that you'd like to, you know, someone to come together
yeah.
with something. Maybe there's a synergy between the list that we have bumped up against some of those projects, and sort of see if there are some potential fits.
Sure.
And then just to be clear, is public, sort of this public education and sort of like city offices, would those fall within the parameters of the kind of mission of AEDP, which is the tax base and
mm-hmm.
economic development? Because I think some of what Beth and I were talking about, this is about, you know, stewardship of existing assets, and so would there be some sort of squishiness in being eligible for IDA funds or
so I mean right here on the eligible projects list, elementary and secondary school facilities, parking facilities.
So it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. I guess we'd have to get some clarification on like city facilities, but
okay.
we could easily get that clarification. I think in terms of it being aligned with economic development, I'd go back to what I said a little while
right.
ago.
Yeah.
Like, if we don't have a great school system and we don't have the right type of affordable and mix of housing, like,
mm-hmm. yeah.
our job is, you know, 10 times harder.
So I think that's really important, and because we're being recorded, and I think this is a clear vehicle for, you know, alternative
potential.
Delivery vehicle,
yeah.
clear
yeah.
potential.
Yeah.
That's on the table.
Are you
yeah.
aware of any in Virginia that have used like a true public school? I know you mentioned Episcopal, who
mm-hmm.
is
mm-hmm.
independent.
I don't know off the top of my head, but I can certainly find out.
So Coral,
mm-hmm.
Torpedo Factory and this building, is there, the city owns them both, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, simplistic terms, without any debt on them, own them free and clear.
Well,
I'm asking.
I think you would know more than me,
but I don't know about the Torpedo Factory. This building, relatively certain that we don't have any outstanding.
But again, it's the thing of what Arthur was saying, which is there may be expenditures on this building that have not yet been.
Right.
paid for,
right.
but it's not like it's been pledged, the asset has been pledged to pay that off.
Well, putting deferred maintenance and other issues aside, locationally, these have got to be the two most valuable properties the city owns.
I
can't think of anything.
I think locationally, that's probably
yeah.
correct. We do assess, like the Torpedo Factory has an assessment value, a real estate assessment value. Is that ringing a bell with anybody? I mean, we have some
basis
to measure to
yeah.
measure that.
Certainly, the office buildings that sort of surround it too.
I just
don't remember.
Right, and that's another thing when General Services talks with us and they're looking at kind of leased office opportunities as well. You know, the city leases a very significant portion of real estate right here on King Street, which is also. Relatively valuable, and they've been looking. They've been trying to take advantage of the market as they assess their portfolio and look. And we have shared tons of information with them.
But the valuation, real estate tax valuation, has to relate to the purpose for which it's being used. So, for example, I suspect when Orinoco was redeveloped from sheet metal workers, it went way up. And by the way, I can pretty much guarantee nobody has a child who lives in the Orinoco.
That's right.
That nobody's putting pressure on the schools there. And by the same token, when the Ford building, when the ELOFs, they went from whatever the valuation was when it was an empty building to what it is now, that has to have increased.
Yes, so the Orinoco, I think this is where, I'm doing this from memory, was sheet metal workers, it was assessed at $300 a foot, and sales are at $1,200 a foot. So that was definitely the one that jumped the most. ELOFs definitely doubled, maybe a little bit over doubled.
Okay. Well, we wanted to transition. Do you mind passing me the remote?
Oh, sure.
Thank you. Okay, so I didn't want to stop this conversation. It was a great conversation. We wanted to kind of summarize what we've been talking about in terms of the resources available, understand how that can work into this ongoing framework and processes, because while we do have a set of projects in front of us right now, we're trying to look forward thinking. So there may be characteristics of those projects, and you might have some creative ideas on those themselves, but looking at, in terms of collecting your creative ideas on our current set of projects, but also framing that and what are the characteristics of those projects to set a set of guidelines and, you know, new processes to explore partnerships and alternative delivery. We were gonna, and I'll be really quick with this, I'm gonna skip to this one. The last week with the task force meeting, we talked about how to prioritize and that decision-making methodology for projects into the capital improvement program by measuring and looking at evaluating its level of need, its level of readiness, and its value proposition to the city. We wanted to take those kind of three pillars and ask ourselves and to kind of take that process and frame it within this discussion of, you know, what can we learn from when we're going through that CIP development process that could help inform our alternative delivery discussion, and what are likely candidates, what are indicators that we learn through that process, maybe in terms of readiness, for example, you know, land has been a continual discussion point, and we know that there's about 8 projects in that list that need land to be identified in some manner. And how do we identify them? So we can relate it back to that process and understand what opportunities may come out of it, and how do we start to frame it in terms of checking for alternative options so that there's a consistent way to look at it. Because there will be opportunities, and this came up last week, while we want to be strategic, we also want to be opportunistic. So the opportunities will come, and we want some sort of framework to measure those opportunities, but also as well as during a regular review of projects, how do we create a strategic approach?
So I think Stephanie's presentation was a great sort of segue into this discussion, because, you know, the objective of our first subcommittee meeting was really to kind of give an overview of what alternative delivery is, what the opportunities are for P3, for co-location. Today we really want to dive into and start thinking about, to Beth's point, what are these indicators we should be looking for when we're looking at these projects? What are the questions we should be asking for whether a project is suitable for alternative delivery? So at the larger task force meeting, there was discussion about these three pillars of need, value, and readiness. And the questions you would ask are really kind of within those three categories. What I call them are prompts, but really when you're thinking about is a project, does it make sense for alternative delivery, you want to start thinking, asking yourself questions related to need, readiness, and value. So for example, to Beth's point about readiness, is there land available, or are we talking about, I keep going back to Gatsby's Tavern, because while maybe there isn't such a strong need for redeveloping Gatsby's and getting it operating from the city's perspective, from a mission perspective, there is an easy vehicle to do that and get that revenue stream improved and working to the city's benefit. And so there's all these trade-offs, and, you know, we're trying to come up with this very structured way of looking at it, but it's just not structured, because every project is going to have its own
kind of hair on it, that you have to think through the sort of trade-offs between need, readiness, and value. So the prompts that we have here, ability to shift risk, need for a project champion, feasible ownership structure, that list of bullet points, those are, you know, if you think about the successful things that, characteristics that make a P3 or a partnership successful, those are really the sort of things we're looking for. I would argue that the most important one for consideration when you're evaluating projects is your opportunity to shift risk. You know, there's different types of risk, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But thinking about what the city's mission is, what the school district's mission is, and what you're willing to sort of trade off in order to meet your objectives on a per project basis and globally in the entire CIP. Stakeholder support, project champion. In an earlier discussion when we were talking about the IDA and that process, I know that, or the idea of the torpedo factory, how people can be, the public can perceive that to be as, oh my gosh, you're giving away this great treasure to the private sector, and there's all this possibility of that being a failure or you know, us losing out on the benefit. And so really having that clear project definition and being able to communicate with transparency to stakeholders what the benefits of this transaction are and how the transaction will look. I think that's very important to consider. So when we're looking at the projects in the CIP list and you say, hey, this is something that we can execute with a partner, with the help of AEDP, it can be a very transparent process and the benefit can be clearly laid out to the public. I think that's another sort of important indicator when you're looking at these individual projects. And then what I call, or we call, project definition, which is really kind of the meat, which is having a clear, you know, a clear plan for the project, a clear goals, a feasible ownership structure, and a budget or revenue stream that, again, you can use to promote the transparency of the project. I was struggling with this because I kept thinking that you have to figure out the nugget between need, readiness, and value before you can consider whether or not alternative delivery is an option, but really it's just part of the conversation. So I would say that the charge of the subcommittee, as we're all aware, is really thinking about, as the CIP is evolving, also, you know, having that line of thinking, the alternative delivery questions. So when you're, you know, informing the larger committee about what projects make sense, those additional kind of boxes have been checked or thought through. You can go to the next slide. I mentioned earlier that risk, that shifting risk is really what I consider to be the most important consideration that should be given to each individual project. There are certain, I would imagine there are certain projects in the CIP that that the city, it's completely mission aligned and the city doesn't want to outsource that risk. Then there's probably other projects where that is less so. And so thinking about risk in terms of design and construction, we talked about this quite a bit last at the last meeting, the different design build, the different ways you can get a project developed, and shifting risk in terms of guarantees or who's on the hook for development, et cetera. Operational risk, which is similar to the concessionaire model we talked about with the Norfolk waterfront, or what I see with some of my higher education clients, which is, we are going to give you all the operation risk, private partner, because you know how to do this well. And, in turn, we will, there will be some sort of economic benefit. So we will, receive the benefit of your operations, and you will receive the benefit of some sort of payment or fee. And then political and macro. I mean, frankly, I've never in my 10-year career had to deal with force majeure until last week with a client in Florida. What do we do when a hurricane sweeps through and sets your project back? I'm like, getting. So these are all risks, right? That you have to think through and think through who, if this project, if we can share some of these risks, then it makes sense to consider an alternative delivery method. So you know, Mignon, Dwight, and Dave, I mean, these are things I know you are already thinking about and sort of preaching to the choir here as you analyze the projects in the CIP, but also to Beth's point, like how can we somehow codify this so in the future, when future decisions are being made, the task force or folks are aware of how to think through these issues in order to make educated decisions about whether or not a project could be flagged or, you know, some other method.
I think that was a really excellent summary. And on this slide in particular, as we look at alternative delivery methods, I think you have the order of the three absolutely right. But the size of the box for the political and macro, you can't make it big enough.
No. Yes.
I say that out of respect for all public entities, but especially for Alexandria, Virginia. Yeah. And I think that's a problem.
And I think, Rhonda, Dwight, do you have any thoughts about that before I?
That's kind of the reason that we are here today, mm-hmm. is that there's a lot of concerned citizens, and they all have a voice, and they all have the ear of the people that make the political decisions, and they're not all in concert, and so we've just been stuck doing nothing.
Something you said, Dwight, the last name that really resonated was that, you know, we keep shooting for the absolute best and we're suffering as a result, because there's a lot of good that can be done in that in between if people are willing to take those risks and be forthcoming with stakeholders and accept that not everyone's going to support the solution.
The adage that keeps popping into my mind as I'm sitting here is perfection is the enemy of good enough. And right now, we are in a position where we need a whole lot of good enough, and perfection is not necessarily achievable on very many of these projects. It's going to be required for a few of them. You can't have a gun range where bullets go flying into the crowds.
You don't want to co-locate that with the school.
Yeah. So, but there's a lot of the projects where, you know what, a good enough solution would be so infinitely better. And when we have a good enough solution to get some school seats in here now, mm-hmm. is a whole lot better than the perfect solution.
So the now, I think, is important, because when we came into this process, we have the list, and we have the time frame, and we have the budget, and we have what's been proposed for the next year, the next year, the next year, the next year. And I do think that priorities have to be rejuggled once we understand what the projects are. I think you said exactly, to define the projects is absolutely essential. Has there been any progress on which projects could be coupled and which ones shouldn't be? Has there been any work with the other committees about some of those? Because, again, defining where we go with alternative delivery is going to be a function of, I mean, it's form follows function. And I think functionally, once we have a better feeling for what we know can go together and what we know we don't want to go together, then it can help to better clarify some of the elements that you brought up about, you know, what's possible and what's not possible. And the other thing that you said that's very important in my experience has been making sure that, I mean, these are public meetings, but we from the larger committee have to figure out a way to ensure that it's not just that it's on the website or it's published, but the community has got to understand that compromises, that good enough in some cases are going to be the order of the day. And we're not going to try to shove things, the city council not going to shove things down your throat, but once we've made our recommendations and the politics get into it, mm-hmm. there has to be a commitment from all stakeholders that we've got a priority that has to be met for our children, mm-hmm. and for our public and service missions for the city. And that there's going to have to be commitment and compromise acceptance in some cases that we'll hear and we'll have to try to respond to, but we'll have to be made. And that's an ongoing. But I mean, educating.
Right.
Because what I have found is that as much as we're doing talking, as soon as it gets ready to come into execution, nobody's going to remember. They're all going to say, you said so and so, and my understanding was X.
Right.
And so, you know, it wasn't this. So, I mean, we'll get to that bridge,
yeah,
when we cross it, but my big question right now is, where are we with understanding what how we can define each of the, you know, combined, potential combined projects.
Well, that's a task for this committee to talk about.
Okay.
So it hasn't been happening in another committee.
Okay.
In terms of looking at project, so, because the CIP that we're seeing it now, you know, we're going to be modeling it through the criteria, assuming these scopes stay in place for right now.
Okay.
And so the charge is, if there are project definitions, and I'll use the word scope, but project definitions that you want to say, let's reconsider, you know, this is the one we think should be reconsidered, we can begin talking about those. We won't have the time frame to begin running a new case or a new business case for it, or, you know, really understanding that scope of work, but we can begin to, you know, conceptualize it. And if as we do model it, we want to do kind of a placeholder project that represents that. But for the sake of this exercise, because of the time frame and needing that October deadline, we're assuming these current scopes. But on the side, we'll have, you know, we've started calling it the super memo. On the side, we'll have the projects that you think should be redefined in different manners. So then that's what we wanted to get some early ideas from you all, particularly after we've had this conversation. And part of that super memo too is also kind of those other considerations for the, what I would call like the framework or the guiding principles that need to be put in place. Because you'll look at opportunities, and again, it's kind of balancing between being opportunistic as well as strategic.
Okay, we have a little chicken and egg thing going on.
Yeah.
But okay,
we did agree at committee level that also committees would take into consider opportunities for co-location. So I
That's what I thought that each committee was considering.
Yes.
Well, in that mindset, like I'll use co-location as an example. So here it's kind of a gray area in a few cases. So co-location in terms of maybe maintenance and operations, what agreements, what MOU needs to be put in place that would help define, you know, who's stuck in the toilet paper and that type of agreement, and how does that go about?
Okay, so that's our first priority, in my opinion, mm-hmm. is the physical co-location.
Okay,
so,
yes.
So, you know, the next time, because we're heading in on the end of our time
mm-hmm.
here, I think understanding our next step with whatever
mm-hmm.
AEDP can bring to the table, and then really doing something
yep.
that helps us, you know, I don't know whether it's what kind of session
yeah.
it is.
Yeah,
but,
well, and
you know, it might be one of those card sessions
yes.
where we, you know, do
right.
that.
Right, and thinking about the project subcommittee, which I suspect you probably already have your list in mind of which ones you would flag for additional consideration for alternative delivery. I mean, that's to Beth's point.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is to say, here's the CIP, because we are moving at ludicrous speed on this time frame. I don't mean ludicrous to be judgment, I just mean it's fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in addition to that, while we're moving on this path, we want to flag these and start thinking about these on a parallel path as how we might be able to move them up or move them around to impact the CIP in a beneficial way and achieve more of the goals more quickly and efficiently.
I agree with you. We're moving at a ludicrous pace. However, I think that's the opportunity that we have, is everything else in this city takes a protracted period of time, and as a result, in my opinion, gets totally watered down because we end up with a perfect solution that is never implementable. If we can take advantage of the momentum we have, all the people around this table, the focus that this is getting, and get something and help to then sell it to the community when the political people have to get the political cover to do this, that is really the opportunity to make impact. I did not volunteer all my time here
mm-hmm.
to write a super memo.
Mm-hmm.
I volunteered my time to make this happen, and we need to take advantage of the speed in which the city council set up this process to get these things implemented.
Mm-hmm.
I would be very saddened that I wasted time that I spent with my kids or on my business or had coffee with friends if all we do is produce a super memo that just sits around and becomes another report that
right.
is in
yep.
the archives.
And I just want to say really quick, the ludicrous speed is from Spaceballs, and that's a movie reference.
It is.
And
it's from Elon Musk. Ludicrous.
That's right. We're okay with ludicrous.
I didn't want to.
Super memo was the point.
So, yeah.
I want to know that in context.
Yeah.
We know that you all have what you have to do. We know that from a deliverable standpoint, Dave and Dwight and I have been asked to do for the larger goal is to come up with the, you know, the hairy ball idea stuff.
Yep.
And so we have to, you know, we're going to push that. I think we hit on something really great with talking with AEP. And I've also asked Brailsford to look into another alternative delivery financing group that's going around to the various public sector organizations making pitches, and maybe there's an angle there that we could explore, not in the next meeting, the one after, because the next meeting I think we need to do this exercise.
Yeah, I would say, you know, at the next meeting, if the subcommittee is able to come back and say we've, you know, and it doesn't have to be collectively, but here are the projects that we think are an opportunity, we can start asking these questions and, you know, coming up with that sort of outline business plan of how it can be implemented.
So you are going to lead us through an exercise. I mean, we're going to have our ideas about some
right,
things.
We'll
do our homework, but you're going to lead us through some.
We're not here to recommend the projects,
yes.
Right?
I didn't say recommend.
Yeah.
I said facilitate.
We're here to
facilitate a working session on what projects could be aligned and co-located.
Mm-hmm.
I think to do that in a public setting is absolutely necessary.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
And I think if we have a whiteboard session or a, you know, what do you call it, you know, with a card session,
yes,
or whatever, with the color, we need to do that, and it'd be really, really excellent. And again,
yeah,
that
great
half
job
of it, and AEP,
yeah,
give us another half on where are the opportunities,
yeah,
that they're managing.
And I mean, Deb has been thinking about co-location opportunities too, so we can together facilitate a discussion with you. Sure.
Any other questions from the table?
Well, I just want to say one thing, because and I wasn't going to say it, but then Carl just really reminded me that, I mean, we toured city schools, we toured city facilities, and I have a lot of respect for what the staff folks have had to do. I think that we saw some duct tape solutions to some of the maintenance issues, and I don't think that is the people who are on the ground's fault. I think, frankly, the political environment doesn't necessarily encourage people putting their head up out of the foxhole and saying, I think there's a better way to do it. And I think the city staff and school staff has done a great job within the parameters that they've been forced to work. And I think part of what we need to elevate is bringing to, you know, the political leadership's view some things. We're, you know, from taking a step back, thinking outside the box, giving a more strategic view of things. So it's not just about keeping the school open on Monday, but, you know, what about the Monday, you know, 3 years from now? So we appreciate what you guys did.
There is not a single idea that I've got in my notes as alternatives that was original. It has all come out of these conversations with everyone who does this for a day job. It's like, oh, well, at some point somebody mentioned this, but for whatever reason we were told to go in a different direction. And so I think part of, if we're going to make a lasting impression, we have to help make leadership aware that we need a culture change so that things just don't get shoved aside because we're spending too much time telling people what to do rather than what needs to be accomplished. If we can get that cultural change, I think the need for this committee will never happen again.
And with that, thank you.
Great, thank you.
I want you to finish this.